Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Edirne First and 15. Our guest today is Professor Ioana Gache, which is the president of the IACI. She's basically focusing today on asthma and a new development and researches on asthma. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
It's really a pleasure for us to have you here. This has happened because of our participation and collaboration with the IACI Juniors, which is very, very important. We built this association with the IACI Juniors a few months ago, and we are glad for your participation. Would you like to start your presentation and your topic, which is endotype-driven approach, a step towards precision medicine? Thank you.
So thank you for your kind introduction and for the invitation. I'm very glad to be here with you today. And we really appreciate this collaboration from the IACI side, because you know IACI is a very young organization, and we encourage very much fellows in training and junior members to, and we try to support as much as possible the development of their profession. So I will talk about this concept, which is not novel, but it's very fashionable. Precision medicine, and why not precision health, because we want to go towards prevention more and do not reach the status of the disease. So this is defined by four key features. One is personalized care, which is based on molecular, immunologic, and functional endotyping of the disease, and this will be my focus today. The other three are also very important because we need to look into the participation of the patient. The third is predictive, and the fourth is prevention. But I will focus mainly on the personalized care. And because I'm focusing on this, I would like to make some clarifications in terms of definitions that we will use. Because personalized is not the same with stratified. Personalized meaning that you custom to the individual, and stratified is that you use groups, so subpopulations with differences between susceptibility to a disease or response to a particular treatment. The difference between the two comes from what you measure. So, for example, or what you use. Because if you talk about personalized medicine, then you'd rely on pharmacogenetics. If you talk about stratified medicine, then the biomarkers and endotypes are the key tools that you will use. So what I will talk today is mainly about this stratified approach based on biomarkers and endotypes. What are these, and why do we need this precision medicine to approach allergic disease and asthma and other chronic diseases as well? First of all, because they are umbrella for different diseases. So if you see, each patient is a different disease, although they have the same diagnosis. And we need to stratify this approach because we want to have a better selection of responders to treatment or to other management approach, to predict risk and design what is really a disease-modifying strategy that means achieving cure in chronic disease. First of all, we look in each patient to what we call visible properties. Visible properties characterize a disease phenotype. It can be anything. It can be clinical, it can be physiologic, it can be morphologic characteristic, it can be response to treatment. So anything you can see is a visible property and characterizes the disease phenotype. For example, for asthma, we use the following visible properties. We look at the history of the patient, onset, triggers, we assess comorbidities. You know that asthma frequently is associated with allergic rhinitis or chronic rhinosinusitis. We evaluate response to treatment. To this, because it is a chronic disease, we look at the vital risk and also the long-term outcome, for example, the risk of exacerbations or decline in lung function. We measure lung physiology and remodeling. These are also visible properties. And last but not least, we assess the type of inflammation. And we have two types of inflammation in asthma, which is eosinophilic and non-eosinophilic. Non-eosinophilic has different subtypes. It can be neutrophilic, pausy granulocytic with the less inflammatory cells or macrophages present. Unfortunately, these visible properties, which are phenotypes, are not related to the pathogenic mechanism, defined by what we call an endotype, a term that was coined more than 10 years ago by an Australian researcher in his Lancet paper. And a successful endotype, so if we want to define well the pathogenic mechanism, it should be linked to the clinical phenotype via what we use as biomarker. Fortunately, we have new approaches to look more into these disease endotypes because we have more accessible tools for human immunophenotyping. We have specific targeted immune therapies with biologicals, which target cytokines or receptors. We have the application of omics, and these all, they lead to what we call the data-driven disease endotype. What do I mean by this? We use here new statistical tools, and these new statistical tools are very potent in generating and in evaluating a huge amount of data. So we can use supervised analysis, latent class analysis, Bayesian network analysis, topological data analysis, network analysis, so on and so forth. And this has changed very much the way we do research today, because until now, we were using this approach, which was hypothesis driven. So we had a hypothesis and we built based on visible properties, the phenotype clusters of disease. Let's say asthma associated with obesity, asthma associated with rhinitis, and with so on and so forth. With this new advent, with this endotype biomarker approach, we change into these unbiased data-driven models where you don't have any hypothesis when you start. So this will generate new hypotheses, and this is very important. I will show you in the end. The key tool that we have linking the visible property with the mechanism is the biomarker. When we are talking about a biomarker, we have to look at two properties. One is one which is obvious, which is validity, but we usually forget about the second one, which is relevant. Validity means that the biomarker is reproducible and it's usable as a diagnostic test. So it should be easily measurable and affordable. But the biomarker has to be relevant as well. Relevant means that it is specific to the mechanism, so it's specific to the pathway. And it's also related to the clinical endpoint, which we called a surrogate endpoint. For example, asthma exacerbation or lung function decline. What we have now in allergic diseases, with the majority, we just predict treatment response. Very few forecast disease risk, so we can use them for prevention, and very few forecast disease progression into more severe forms of disease. They are mostly suitable for research setting, and all they need to be validated and qualified. What is validation and qualification? As defined by Food and Drug Agency, validation is the process of assessing if the biomarker is reproducible and gives you accurate data. So it measures the performance of the biomarker. And is very different from qualification. Qualification is linking the biomarker with the biological process and with the clinical endpoint. This is very important. And none of the biomarkers that we have now in allergic diseases is qualified. Like, for example, is C-reactive protein in cardiovascular disease. When we think of a biomarker, we have to establish if it is a marker for the mechanism or if it is the key mechanism of the endotype itself. And this is very important because if it is a marker, so it's just associated, then it will guide treatment. For example, blood eosinophils, this type of biomarker, guiding treatment. If it is the key mechanism, then it is the therapeutic target itself. For example, interleukin-5, which drives the accumulation of the LDA. So coming back to this, so the problem with the biomarker is it's highly variable across age, across severity, and across time. And we have to deal with this variability and to define it better. For this, always the evaluation should be longitudinal of a biomarker. And I give you here three examples. For example, lung function in patients with well-controlled asthma. And if you follow them for 3 years, you can see that there are patients here to the left which are rapid decliners in the range of COPD. This rapid decline in lung function is correlated with the loss of asthma control and also with the risk of increased exacerbations and decline in lung function furthermore. So this longitudinal evaluation of lung function is very important for prediction of the risk as a biomarker. Inflammation is also very important. If you measure, for example, exhaled nitric oxide, then you can easily see that if it is persistently high, it is linked to less asthma control, persistent airway obstruction, and fast lung function decline, both in adults and in children. And, for example, if you look at sputum eosinophils, also longitudinal evaluation is extremely important. You have patients with persistent low eosinophils in the sputum or persistent high. But the most interesting are the cluster which have high and low values of eosinophils, because the lung function decline is huge. And these are the high risk patients for developing chronic asthma, severe asthma, and posing treatment challenges. So this type of asthma endotypes, for sure, we use them in research. What I would like to discuss with you today is that if they are ready for the clinic, first of all, we need to understand that there are many factors that modulate the disease endotype. For example, the endotype, the mechanism of the disease, is driven, because it is an immune disease, by innate and adaptive immune response. And also already the cooperation here between multiple pathways is very complex. On top of it, you have modulation by genetic and epigenetic factors, and also what is outside. For example, the exposome, the microbiome, and the nutrition. Also, the anatomical factor, the dysfunction of the epithelial barrier, and also the intervention of the remodeled resident cells, like the airway smooth muscle, modulate the endotype. Last but not least, metabolic pathways, for example, association with obesity or aspirin sensitivity, they also modulate the endotype. And last but not least, the psychological. And with this, we need to understand that there are two types of endotypes in asthma. One is what we call single molecular mechanism, which could be, for example, periostin high, asthma which is responsive to IL-13 targeted intervention. The problem is here that usually this does not exist in real life, and we are dealing. So this umbrella that I have shown you at the very beginning has many slices, and each of these slices is a sub-endotype. So we are talking about a complex endotype, one example being type 2 asthma. So the multiple slices are driven by different pathways in different allergic diseases. And according to the targeted interventions that we have now for allergy and asthma, we have a pathway which is driven by IL-5, by IL-4, IL-13, and by IgE, which can be local or systemic. And you can see that in different allergic diseases, this pathway cooperates differently. For example, in allergic rhinitis, you will have majority of IL-4, IL-13, systemic and local IgE, and you will have less intervention of the IL-5. So there are multiple non-type driven molecular subendotypes as well in non-type 2 inflammation, which are characterized by the neutrophilic inflammation, the type 17 pathway, the barrier defect, and the neurogenic inflammation, again, with different contributions into the different allergic diseases, asthma, rhinitis, chronic rhinosinusitis, and atopic dermatitis. Also, for atopic dermatitis, you can see that there are different endotypes which characterize the non-lesional skin, the acute disease flares, and the chronic remitting relapsing atopic dermatitis. And this is very important when we measure the targeted interventions like dupilumab, ustekinumab, or nemolizumab in different forms of atopic dermatitis. Because you can see in acute disease flares, there is a predominance of the type 2 immune response, so dupilumab will be very efficient on acute disease flares. While, for example, in the chronic remitting relapsing atopic dermatitis, the type 1 intervention, the type 1 inflammation and immune response will be there, and it has to be targeted by a different biologicals. So is the endotype-driven approach working? We have a lot of type 2 asthma biomarkers, and it's obvious that we cannot use them all in the clinic. So what we try to do is to reduce them to what we measure in blood in induced sputum or in exhaled breath. The problem is that, for example, if you look at the eosinophils, they predict response to all the interventions that you have now in asthma. So to anti-IL-5, anti-IgE, IL-4, IL-13, and also to corticosteroids. And this is the problem, because same biomarkers you have for different targeted interventions. The second problem is that there is no consistent validity for this. And I will give you two examples here. If you target IgE4 with omalizumab, it works perfectly and it decreases asthma exacerbations. Here we tested a new monoclonal which targets IgE, which is called quilizumab. You can see very well that it decreases IgE, both total and specific. So it should work as omalizumab does, because it has the same pharmacological intervention. The problem is that it had no effect on asthma exacerbation on either of the doses that we have tried. So the same target works with omalizumab, doesn't work with another monoclonal targeting IgE. Second, for example, the famous periostin, which is used as a biomarker for asthma because it was related to eosinophilic inflammation and related to response to treatment. And it reflects lung eosinophilia very well. The red line which you see here, it reflects lung eosinophilia better than exhaled nitric oxide or blood eosinophils or specific IgE, but this happens only in severe asthma. And it is also very well related with serum IgE and with blood eosinophils, but again, this happens in severe asthma. When we try to evaluate the value of the periostin in moderate asthma, you can see that it falls out of the type 2 inflammation cluster, so where you have IL-5, IL-13, and eosinophilia. So periostin is not related at all with eosinophilia, opposed to IL-5 and IL-13. So unfortunately, it did not predict the type 2 inflammation, and we measured periostin with three different periostin assays. No correlation whatsoever with eosinophilia, either at high levels or normal levels of serum IgE. In terms of response to treatment, it was shown in the lebrikizumab trials that the high periostin group predicted better, responded better to the intervention. But this was not reproduced in mild asthma, which did not receive at all inhaled steroids, and was not reproduced in phase 3 lebrikizumab studies, and the product was stopped. So periostin is not a good biomarker and is not used anymore in the clinic today. Third problem that we have with this endotype-driven approach is that the targeted intervention that we have now for asthma with monoclonals are not a disease modifier, and I will show you what happens if you stop mepolizumab. Mepolizumab targets the eosinophils, the IL-5, and immediately when you stop treatment with mepolizumab, eosinophils are back and also exacerbations are back. The next problem is that there is a frequent overlap between the visible property and the biomarker. And the best example that I can give you here is eosinophilic asthma, because eosinophilic asthma is defined by sputum or blood eosinophils and histopathologic demonstration in the airway. But these are visible properties, so this is a phenotype. The confusion comes with the fact that it is associated with type 2 gene, type 2 inflammation, and with significant response to treatments that suppress eosinophilia, so it is as well a biomarker. So the confusion is there because we don't know how shall we use eosinophilia as a visible property or as a biomarker. Next problem is what we call a dissociated effect and the efficacy at the target site. Because when you evaluate the response to a targeted intervention, it's always the mechanisms of the immune inflammatory pathway, but there are always differences between individuals, which is obvious, but also the same individual responds better with lung function or with exacerbations, never both. So you have to choose between the biomarker-driven treatment or the outcome-driven treatment. So what would you like to achieve in your patient? Have a better lung function or decrease exacerbations? And I will give you one example of that this really happens. Again, coming to mepolizumab. This is the meta-analysis of all the mepolizumab trials of anti-IL-5 intervention. And you can see here that it works on improving FEV1. Not dramatically, but it works well on FEV1. Unfortunately, it does not work at all on hyperreactivity. So, which is a cardinal feature of asthma. So airway hyperactivity is not influenced at all. And also patients continue to use rescue medication. So they still have symptoms. So this mepolizumab influences very well asthma exacerbations, decreases and improves lung function, but does not touch at all symptoms or bronchial hyperactivity. So you do not achieve complete asthma control using this due to this dissociative effect. Now, because I presented you to a series of problems that we have we simplify too much in this biomarker-driven approach, I will try to show you how we can solve it. And with this, I would like to introduce to you the concept of multidimensional endotyping. Multidimensional endotyping meaning that you use this topological data analysis, which is a machine learning program, and you input all the features that you have there, and you start building clusters, but the clusters will be built in an unbiased way. So you have no hypothesis. And to our surprise, when we use this methodology with, let's say, more than 30 clinical features, molecular biomarkers, so everything was inputted into the machine learning, and then the machine provided us with very nice clusters. Very nice clusters which can correspond to the asthma severity, as defined by Global Initiative for Asthma, and by blood eosinophilia. So we have one cluster which is mild asthma, low eosinophilic, three clusters which are moderate asthma, one is non-eosinophilic, the second one is medium, the third one is high eosinophilic, and two clusters of severe asthma. One is non-eosinophilic, the next one is low eosinophilic. And we have learned a lot looking at these clusters. What are their characteristics? So for example, if you look in the first row, where you look at the clinical characteristics, so they reflect very well asthma control, so mild asthma, severe asthma, the level of lung function, the level of exacerbation, and they correspond very well with the types of asthma which are early onset or late onset asthma. Now, the big surprise is when you look here, for example, asthma with exacerbations, because here you will have the patients with more exacerbations in the severe asthma cluster. But if you look at these two clusters, they have low levels of IL-5 and even lower levels of DPP-4, which is also a type 2 cytokine. So this that would be targeted by the biological, because when you recommend mepolizumab, it has to be severe asthma, it has to have exacerbations and some eosinophilia. And in these patients, actually the target of the biologicals, which would be IL-5 or IL-13, are very low. So the patients will be not very well selected by using your clinical criteria. We suggest the following approach for asthma, at least to close to the stage of precision medicine. First of all, you characterize the phenotype. This we already do. But we have to make a step forward and look at the disease mechanism, so disease endotype. And at least you can use these biomarkers in blood, in sputum, or in exhaled breath to divide your patients into two major categories, type 2 or non-type 2 immune response. And with this, you go and tailor your treatment. Last but not least, you have to integrate here your prognostic biomarkers because primary and secondary prevention are very important for these patients. What would be the key points for moving the field forward? First of all, we need to understand the concept of these sub-endotypes, so multiple pathways working inside the big umbrella. Then we need, besides inflammation, to look at the airway smooth muscle, epithelium, and epigenetic modifications. With these lots of data, I have shown you one example of systems medicine that you can use. And the next step will be the validation and qualification of the biomarker that comes out of this system medicine. And with all this in mind, the concept of endotypes and system medicine, we need to redefine the nomenclature. So it will not be asthma. It will be type 2 asthma with a different mechanism, so based on the endotype. Then we have to integrate the health information technology. The patient-centered environment is very important, and we have to measure the cost-effectiveness of what we are delivering because we want to reach this ideal biomarker in us. So, dear colleagues, is precision medicine ready for the clinic? We have some arguments that it is there. For example, we, at least for type 2 asthma and for atopic dermatitis, we already use this biomarker-driven treatment because we measure type 2 cytokines before we take the decision of initiating the treatment with a biological. We already use these unbiased data-driven models, especially in research. Health information technology, which provides you with data in real time, is quickly advancing. And we have a lot of pressure and support from patients and society because the concept of precision medicine is very appealing to the patient. He wants to have patient treatment tailored to his needs. Unfortunately, we still have to qualify our biomarker as pathway specific. When we have this huge data that come from the omics field, we have to translate them into clinical decision algorithm, and we are not there yet. In terms of health information technology, this is very nice, but there is a huge variation between countries in resources and also limits in patient expertise in population subgroups. For example, the elderly will not be able to use this. And also we have to convince the regulators and the policymakers, bringing them strong economic arguments to implement the changes for a precision medicine. And with that, I would like to invite you to our Congress, which will be beginning of June in Lisbon, in Portugal. We have a strong ENT section in the IACI, and of course, we have a huge junior member assembly that you will collaborate very well with in the fellowship and mentorship program. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much for this this topic with tons of new information that will be available for this for our juniors and for our colleagues. Briefly, two questions that I have. I guess those are from our rhinology colleagues. Would you please, this is a resident because he's asking, would you please clarify the so-called term rhinobronchial syndrome and how this connection between asthma and rhinitis could be better treated by the connection between the pneumologist and the rhinologist?
Well, this is a very interesting question. I would not use the term rhinobronchial anymore.
Yeah, I guess the United Airways disease.
The United Airways disease, which is better to use. And it's very important in terms of endotyping as well, because when we endotype patients, we have to look at what happens as a mechanism in the nose and in the lung at the same time, and what is the connection between the nose and the lung is in terms of mechanism. And here, for example, looking at the major pathway, which could be, for example, local IgE in the nose and local IgE in the lung, or the neurogenic inflammation is also very important, connecting lung and the nose. So these type of connections are very important to target, because when you will use a biological, it will work better if the patient has both chronic rhinosinusitis, for example, and asthma of a certain type. So they are both type 2 or non-type 2, and then you will better tailor your treatment. So it's very important, very good question.
The second question that are coming, very interesting, I guess, how the big data would change the perspective from the lungs and the connection with the nose.
Yeah, a very good question indeed as well, because we have very good data showing that if you measure the transcriptome in the nose, it's very similar to what is happening in the lung. So, but we still need more validation on this. And this means that the nose will be the proxy for the lung, because it's more easily accessible. And this is very important, because then you will measure in the nose and you will extrapolate to the lung and you will construct different profiles of the patient using this big data. So I would encourage very much the research into the transcriptome of the nose and the omics of the nose in general, and try to relate it to what is happening into the lung. The big data for sure will change the way we approach these diseases, because you saw it's a completely unbiased way, and we are generating new hypotheses which would have never been there if we just reduce to simple biomarkers and to simple methods.
Very, very good. So many, many studies are connecting and approaching with this big data. We recently had a conversation with the Professor Falkens during our Belgrade meeting, and she was talking about this connection and collection of data, which is basically very, very important. Last but not least, I would like to ask you questions. How you would change your approach for treating patients that are basically suffering from both uncontrolled asthma but controlled rhinological symptom?
I don't frequently see this kind of patients. So usually both conditions are uncontrolled. And usually the severity goes in parallel. I don't see patients who have severe asthma and their chronic rhinosinusitis is well controlled. Actually, it's vice versa that I see a little bit more often. So the upper airways are better, asthma is controlled and the upper airways are not controlled very well. These are the slower to respond. I would say that achieving control in both upper and lower airways is important. So you should do both in the patient and achieve control both in the upper and the lower with whatever means you have.
Yes, sure. I would like to thank you for being and attending our meeting. I think that we as a rhinologist should change a little bit our thinking while approaching with those complex patients, and this is not only a one-man show, and we should develop more and more collaboration with pneumologists, especially before starting treating a patient. So an algorithm selection of the patient and treatment should be done. By meaning of that, I would like to express how much important is the connection between the collaboration of the juniors by developing articles and studies, and how much importance should be carried on these subendo types and response immune response with endotypes. So thank you again for this for your lecture and for this explanation, but I really do hope to have you once again for the next segment, which is going to be in 2020, for another talk. Basically, we will see much more news after the next few months because of our European position paper on a chronic rhinosinusitis. So once those new information will be developed, I would like also to have you for another talk, if you would like the idea.
Thank you very much for your kind invitation, and I would like to wish everybody happy and peaceful Easter.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you very much, Professor Agaki, and I will see our next meeting, which is going to be 1st of May. Thank you again for attending, and have a nice Easter.